Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world, produced on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio.
This is Amy Antonucci.
And I'm Steve Diamond.
And we're happy to introduce our show to you today, December 3rd, 2011. Today we're in day two of our fall fundraising drive for Portsmouth Community Radio, and we are looking forward to your call to show support for Making Waves and WSCA by becoming a member of the station today.
Our focus for today's show is on power, including radio waves, of the people.
Here's what we have coming up for you. Today's news segment comes from Between the Lines, another independent radio show that we often bring you. Then we'll hear Media Minutes, more news, this time at the intersection of media and democracy.
Hidden Histories gives us a chance to affect history with information on the Senate bill cutting civil liberties here in the U.S., which is being considered now.
We will then turn our focus to the current people's movement, Occupy Wall Street, with an interview on the nationwide suppression of OWS protesters. Outside the Box with Larry Danziger will also talk about Occupy Wall Street with his version of sound bites from the movement.
We'll close today with a speech by Amy Goodman of Democracy Now! On the power of the people in movements from a talk she gave in New York last month. We'll also have music and more, so stay with us. But first, give us a call at 603-430-WSCA to become a member.
That's 430-9722, where we have folks waiting to pick up the phone and talk to you about the options for membership and how you can support this community resource.
Or if you prefer, go to our website, wscafm.org, and become a member online.
Meanwhile, let's hear that news from Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
In Chicago, hundreds of community activists marched outside the mid-October convention of bankers and future traders, chanting Tax Wall Street. Curtis Smith of National People's Action, the lead organizer of the protest, argued for a new tax on financial transactions, including trades on stocks, bonds, and derivatives, to fund human needs. The transaction tax, also known as the Tobin tax, could generate tens of billions of dollars to fund job creation, education, and environmental protection, while at the same time reducing destabilizing financial speculation. Activists in the United States and England have dubbed the tax on stock and bond transactions the Robin Hood tax. In Washington, D.C., National Nurses United, along with other unions, marched to pressure Congress to enact the Financial Transaction Tax, or FTT. An FTT bill was sponsored by Iowa Senator Tom Harkin and Oregon Congressman Peter DeFazio. In the lead-up to the recent G20 summit meeting, the European Commission endorsed enacting a transaction tax starting in 2014. The measure has strong backing from Germany's conservative Chancellor Angela Merkel and conservative French President Nicolas Sarkozy. The transaction tax was first proposed in the 1930s by economist John Maynard Keynes. According to the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a robust Tobin tax could generate $170 billion annually in new federal revenue. Aracelis Upia, a garment worker in the Dominican Republic, received a living wage when she began working for Alta Garcia, a new apparel company dedicated to providing decent wages and working conditions while competing directly with large international clothing conglomerates. Upia now makes $2.60 an hour to sew T-shirts, nearly three times the minimum wage in her poor Caribbean nation. Alta Garcia is the product of a unique partnership between anti-sweatshop groups and Knight Apparel, America's largest seller of college athletic clothing. For years, groups like United Students Against Sweatshops and the Workers' Rights Consortium have sought a production model to manufacture sweatshop-free clothing. An earlier effort, led by Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's ice cream fame, collapsed due to poor management. According to The Nation magazine, the new initiative started in an abandoned Dominican Republic factory that had closed after its workers voted to form a union. In February 2010, Knight CEO Joe Bosich invested $500,000 to repair and upgrade the plant. To be successful, Alta Garcia must establish a market for sweatshop-free apparel in the U.S. Student activists are now promoting the brand, which will need to compete with Nike and Reebok that have long had lucrative licensing deals with major universities. While serving in Camp Arif John in Kuwait, Captain Ryan Jean was ordered to visit the Army chaplain for stating that he did not believe in God. The chaplain berated the captain, now an intelligence officer at Fort Meade, Maryland. The Christian chaplain proclaimed the U.S. military was God's army and advised Captain Jean to immediately resign his commission. 3 years later, Captain Jean is seeking the Army's recognition as a humanist lay leader on the same level as Christian, Jewish, or Muslim lay leaders who aid chaplains in ministering to the troops. According to the Baltimore Sun, Captain Jean is one of a dozen atheists in the U.S. military seeking lay leader status. Thus far, none have been successful. Currently, the U.S. military does not consider atheists or agnostics members of an organized religion, and thus they are not eligible for lay leader status. In recent years, the U.S. military has faced numerous allegations of religious bias, especially at the U.S. Air Force Academy, where fundamentalist Christian staff members and soldiers have aggressively pursued religious converts. Less than 10,000 of the 1.4 million active duty members of the U.S. Armed Forces are self-declared atheists or agnostics. Supporters say many atheists remain hidden in the ranks, afraid to expose themselves to ridicule or bias that would hinder their careers.
That was news from Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. And Portsmouth Community Radio is looking today for you to call and join us as a member of the station.
It's your opportunity to support grassroots media and become a member of local community radio.
Call us at 603-430-9722. That's 603-430-WSCA. Or you can also go online, portsmouthcommunityradio.org. And now for some more news. This time, Media Minutes, bringing us news at the intersection of media and democracy.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Could it be that the days of rubber stamping mega telecommunications mergers in Washington, D.C. are over? Maybe not. But for AT&T at least, the hiccups disrupting its plan to purchase wireless competitor T-Mobile just keep coming. 2 days before Thanksgiving, Federal Communications Commission Chairman Julius Genachowski circulated a draft order calling for an administrative hearing for the proposed merger between AT&T and T-Mobile. Free Press Policy Director Matt Wood explains.
The FCC has a strange set of procedures they have to go through to deny a merger. Before they can deny a merger, they actually have to designate it for a hearing and basically give the merger applicants the chance to make their case in front of an administrative law judge. Most parties never have to do this. It's something that is very rare and something that the FCC generally doesn't do because they tend to approve mergers or put conditions on them even if they approve them. What the FCC did in this case was start that process last week of designating the AT&T T-Mobile merger for a hearing. And usually this is really the kiss of death for a merger because parties just don't want to go through it. It's a very laborious and time-intensive process, something that it's really hard to win in if you're the merger applicant.
The next plot twist? Barely 24 hours after Genachowski issued his order, AT&T made its next move, withdrawing its application from the FCC.
In order to avoid having the FCC's hearing designation order come out, and to avoid facing the music at the FCC and starting down that long path I was just describing, AT&T and T-Mobile said, we hereby withdraw our applications. We might come back again later with the same deal, but right now you can't rule on this because we've taken away our applications. We're not in front of the FCC anymore.
It was a move equivalent to the old, you can't fire me because I quit technique.
The FCC really saw through that to their credit and took a reasonably bold step here because it decided to release the staff report is how it's been framed now. Really, it would have been part of the order that would have come out if AT&T and T-Mobile hadn't kind of cut and run there last week. And they said, you know, you said that the deal is still alive, that you might come back to us, and therefore we here at the commission don't want to bury all the work that we've done. We want to release the findings we've made thus far based on all the evidence that we've seen.
The report doesn't have any binding legal implications, Wood said, but it's safe to say that AT&T has a long road ahead if they plan to continue pursuing this merger.
Most newspapers have guidelines that prohibit the overuse of unnamed sources and stories. To be quoted in a paper of record, you've got to be willing to go on the record. But a new expose in Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's Extra magazine finds that two of the leading mainstream newspapers aren't always following their own rules. Writer Janine Jackson reviewed a week of front-page stories in the New York Times and the Washington Post. 23% of the stories, 18 out of 77, quoted at least one anonymous source. Jackson said that's a remarkably high number for a practice journalists are told to reserve for extreme circumstances.
So here's this rule that they're supposed to follow, and what you find is that they break the rule virtually every day. Officials are anonymous because the situation they're talking about is tense. They're anonymous because they just don't want to go on the record. They're anonymous for all kinds of reasons that don't sound very legitimate and that raise tremendous concern about whether our government officials are really accountable.
Most of the anonymity was extended to government officials commenting on foreign policy and U.S. military activity. And journalists, it appears, are bowing to the pressure to keep sources anonymous.
It definitely served government officials to be able to shroud their actions in secrecy. And I think journalists have simply gone along with it in order to maintain access to those sources.
Jackson says this abuse of anonymity in the press hurts the public's ability to actually know what's going on in the world and to challenge it.
If we're up against nameless, faceless forces, it becomes much harder to identify allies, to understand what's being done, to understand who we can fight against if we disagree with them. I think it contributes to a kind of squelching in general of people's political energy.
Jackson urges the public to contact their newspaper if they see an outrageous abuse of anonymity. But she says the fight for a more transparent press runs deeper.
At the same time, we really have to be rejecting this whole culture of cronyism that exists between high-level corporate journalists and the government officials that they're meant to be scrutinizing. They have a closeness that is institutional, that is decades old, and really at this point, I think the efforts are to get our information around that set of sources and some other outlets, along with challenging the information that they provide.
To read Jackson's story, visit www.fair.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Thanks to Media Minutes, reminding us with that news of the importance that the media plays in the process of democracy and the information that we all get or don't.
It's really an important part of the public discourse in our democracy.
And you can support your local independent radio station today by calling us here at Portsmouth Community Radio at 603-430-9722.
To join and become a member of Portsmouth Community Radio, or go online to do so at portsmouthcommunityradio.org.
Next on Making Waves, we turn to Hidden Histories, which gives us some very recent history and the chance to make a difference with information on a Senate bill that is currently being considered in the United States and that could severely cut our civil liberties.
Hi, I'm Jack R. Johnson, and this is Hidden Histories. Anyone remember habeas corpus, a Latin phrase used in jurisprudence that means you shall have the body? What it means legally is there was the right of the accused to petition before civil legal authority for justice. Habeas corpus prevented law enforcement groups from indefinitely locking people up without charge or trial and not letting detainees see a judge or an attorney. President Bush effectively erased habeas corpus, at least temporarily, when the original Patriot Act was passed and signed into law. President Obama extended its supposedly temporary suspension in 2009. That was bad. But what is going to be discussed in the next few days in the United States Senate is potentially worse. This time, the United States Senate is proposing what amounts to an effective suspension of the Posse Comitatus Act that was originally passed on June 18, 1878, after the end of Reconstruction. The Posse Comitatus Act was intended to limit the powers of local government and law enforcement agencies from using federal military personnel to enforce the laws of the land. It prevents the use of military force against civilians unless by explicit order of Congress. But the United States Senate is now considering the National Defense Authorization Act, or Senate Bill 1867, that has a provision, Section 1031, that would eliminate this protection. Written by Senators John McCain and Carl Levin, this provision effectively declares that American soil is a battlefield. It allows the president and all future chief executives to order the military to arrest and detain American citizens, innocent or not, without charge or trial. Luckily, Senator Udall is proposing an amendment to correct Section 1031. With any luck, that amendment will pass, and the passage of this bill will be a hidden history that didn't need to be written. This is Jack R. Johnson for Hidden Histories.
Thanks to Hidden Histories for that information about Senate Bill 1867. We hope you'll follow up, look into it, and make your voice heard.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, your daily grassroots global unembedded independent international investigative news hour, heard Mondays through Fridays here on WSCA from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. But this is Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice, every Saturday, 12 to 1. Tune in.
And stay tuned on Making Waves to hear more from Amy Goodman later in our show.
But first, give us a call right now to become a member of WSCA, 603-430-9722.
By calling now, you not only support the station, which has now been on air for 7 years, but you'll let everyone know that you support Making Waves. We have been on for just about as long. This is actually our 365th show. We put a lot of work and time and effort into this show. We hope you think it's worth it. And we hope that you will express that support with a call and a membership to the station today, 603-430-9722. And next, we shift our coverage to the Occupy Wall Street movement, another place in which the power of the people is making a difference. This Between the Lines interview will talk about the federal coordination of nationwide suppression of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
In the 10 weeks since the original Occupy Wall Street protest encampment was founded in New York City's Zuccotti Park, the movement has spread to hundreds of other outposts across the U.S. and the world. The message of activists condemning corporate greed, economic inequality, and the corrupting influence of money in politics has resonated with many Americans who are suffering with high unemployment, a record number of mortgage foreclosures, and dimming prospects for the future. Although the U.S. Constitution guarantees the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances, Occupy encampments from coast to coast have been the target of dozens of police raids and evictions ordered by local governments. Disturbingly, some police departments have employed brutal tactics better suited to confronting a terrorist threat than a group of citizens engaged in lawful and nonviolent peaceful protest. Video images of police assaults with truncheons, bloodied faces, and pepper spray being fired into protesters' eyes at point-blank range have gone viral on the internet, generating a backlash against police and increased support for the movement. A leak from an anonymous Justice Department source led many to conclude that the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI had helped to coordinate local police actions suppressing Occupy activists. Your reporter spoke with Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild, who talks about her group's legal intervention to stop Occupy evictions and the filing of a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Department of Justice and other agencies to obtain information on their involvement in coordinating the nationwide crackdown on the Occupy protest encampments.
Since really 1999, when we had the World Trade Organization protests, we started to see, and it became known later as the so-called Miami model, but basically a nationally coordinated method of crowd control used by various levels of law enforcement. And one of the tactics that we observed before national special security events like the RNC, the DNC, was preemptive arrests, raiding of organizers' spaces. For example, when people were making puppets in Philadelphia at the RNC in 2000, pretextual raids saying that there was a fire code violation or a sanitation or health threat. And in case after case, when this went to the courts, it was found that there was no violation. But it had the effect at the time of shutting down the speech in question, slowing down what the protesters were trying to accomplish. And I think in examples that have come up at Occupy situations, for example, in L.A., well, the mayor allowed the encampment for something like 56 days. and then crack down. And in fact, the city council there had said they supported the tents as expressive activity. So I think that in certain circumstances, even in New York, the encampment was allowed to a certain point. It's almost as though the mayor said, look, we let you be there for a month or so, and now we're sick of it. So I would say that most of the claims of sanitation problems are things that a city or a municipality could come up with solutions for and help accommodate the free speech activity. But we're seeing them used, in our opinion, to shut down this free speech.
Is there anywhere in the Constitution where there's a time limit on freedom of speech?
There's no time limit. And I think that's really kind of the beauty of this movement, is I think many people thought it would be over in a week or two. Cold weather came, and yet the protesters not only were still there, in many cases they were gathering momentum.
I've read reports, as I know many listeners have, about the involvement of federal authorities, namely the Department of Homeland Security, in coordinating some of the local police responses in evictions and raids into Occupy Wall Street encampments in cities large and small. What can you tell us about that?
The National Lawyers Guild, along with the Partnership for Civil Justice based in Washington, D.C., has filed FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, to find out if there were communications or meetings involving the Police Executive Research Forum in October and November, also the U.S. Conference of Mayors, specifically to find out if there was anything, any documents or information pertaining to federal coordination, or even to advice or consultation regarding the police response to the various Occupy protests around the country. I can't imagine with a vast Occupy movement springing up so quickly that there isn't national coordination. It just wouldn't fit into the rubric of current law enforcement practices.
Can a judge basically say, hey, look, this is free speech, and these local police forces and the federal government just ought to back down and let these people have their say?
Well, and that's our goal, is to challenge whatever we find if it seems to be unlawful practices that infringe on people's constitutional rights.
That was Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild. For more news, analysis, and commentary on the Occupy Wall Street movement, visit our Between the Lines special Occupy Wall Street coverage and resource page at btlonline.org.
Thanks to Between the Lines for that interview.
If you want to hear more about the Occupy Wall Street movement, you have a local alternative here on WSCA. Portsmouth Community Radio has Occupy Radio Portsmouth airing every Saturday from 10 to midnight.
Next, we're going to bring you Outside the Box, brought to us by Maine social justice activist Larry Danziger, with resources for organizing and social change and WERU in Blue Hill, Maine. It's definitely the sort of content you're not going to hear on just any radio station. So support WSCA now. Give us a call at 603-430-9722.
And now for Larry Danziger on Making Waves.
Hi there. Here's an outside the box where we try to condense big ideas into small commentaries. Today's topic is occupation soundbites. What do those occupiers want, those on Wall Street and now around the country? It seems that the media and a lot of the public are preoccupied with getting these ideas into a few soundbites. But the occupiers know our problems are hard to describe in a few words. Trying to encapsulate some very complex ideas is not that simple. But as a service to the simple-minded media who want to offer only simple-minded ideas to their readers and viewers, I'll give you my sound bites of what I think these occupations are for. Here goes. We want the economic system to be recreated so that there's a fair and just economy for all, which will then be translated into a democratic political system where each person has an equal and powerful say about what happens in their community and country. Continuing the soundbite format, here's a six-point recreation of that new economy. 1. Equalize pay. Give everyone the same living wage, such as $15 or $20 per hour, no matter what the job. Why should people who work just as hard or harder than millionaires get many times less per hour? 2. Tax individuals, mostly on assets, and tax income only above a certain high threshold, such as $100,000. That redistributes the wealth. 3. Create a cooperative economy where all businesses are owned by workers or producers, no bosses and no associates. 4. Transition to a locally based economy from a globalized one. Then there are no corporations too big to fail or domino effects where a collapse in one country or industry damages economics around the world. 5. Eliminate profit. No payoffs to investors, silent partners, stockholders, or wealthy executives. Any extra money goes back into the business or is taxed. And 6. Guarantee economic human rights to a job, education, health care, food, housing, etc. for everyone. So, to sum up as a visionary soundbite, recreate the economy and democracy by equalizing pay, taxing assets and high incomes, establishing a cooperative worker-owned economy, decentralizing it, eliminating profit, and guaranteeing economic rights for everyone. What's your understanding of the reasons for the recent occupations of Wall Street and other places around the country? Do you support them? I'm Larry Danziger, looking to expand on these sound bites in all my future work for democracy and economic justice.
That was Outside the Box by Larry Danziger, a friend of ours from Maine and WERU in Blue Hill, Maine. Even though that episode he just did for us was about breaking things down so the mainstream media could handle it, we still doubt you'd hear anything quite like it on the mainstream media. What you hear here on Portsmouth Community Radio can be pretty unique. We think it's worth supporting, and we hope you do too.
So call the station now at 603-430-9722 to become a member, or go to portsmouthcommunityradio.org to join online.
Speaking of listener-supported, here's Michael Franti in Spearhead singing listener-supported.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before. We bring the sound communication of our tribal war. Dark vision fly by helicopters in the night. Attempt triangulation of our station in the fight. Straight from the base, deep down, low precision. High crime treason, we broadcast in sedition. Like the Wall Street morning, afternoon edition. Commandeering airwaves from unknown positions. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listener supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded. With information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listener supported. Ha ha.
Mike and my people.
Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The apathetic bull. To send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree. And hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you walking our
off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, while the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that will never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Yeah.
Listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. 6 foot six above sea level, I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level, I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level, I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level, I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot six above sea level, I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level.
That was Michael Frante and Spearhead with Listener Supported. And that's what we are here at Portsmouth Community Radio, so give us a call at 603-430-9722. And now for some fresh perspective from Between the Lines on the ongoing demands for democracy in Egypt.
When tens of thousands of Egyptians gathered in Cairo's Tahrir Square last spring demanding the ouster of U.S.-supported dictator Hosni Mubarak, the nation's armed forces played a decisive role in forcing Mubarak to resign on February 11th. When Mubarak ended his 30-year reign in power, it fell to Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces to organize the nation's transition to democracy. Initially, the military promised a 6-month transition period, after which they would step aside and make way for civilian rule. But when the generals extended their leading role in government to 2 years, Egyptians again took to the streets last week, gathering in Tahrir Square and other cities, demanding a rapid transfer to civilian control, with some calling for a delay in the first round of parliamentary elections. Clashes between police and protesters left more than 40 dead just days before voters went to the polls on November 28th to cast ballots in the initial stage of the nation's first post-Mubarak-era parliamentary election. In flaming anger in the streets, the Egyptian generals stood by their plan to impose a constitution that would give the military control over its own budget and grant the army ultimate political power, as they appointed Kamel Ghansouri, a former Mubarak premier, as Egypt's new prime minister. While refusing to immediately step down, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces pledged instead that elections will be held for a new president by mid-2012, sooner than previously announced. Your reporter spoke with Saif Dinah, associate professor of sociology and international studies at the University of Wisconsin, who explains why he believes the action of Egypt's army constitutes a counter-revolution against the popular uprising that ousted Mubarak from power earlier this year.
The Supreme Military Council in Egypt was supposed to relinquish power to a civilian administration that should oversee the writing of the constitution or the new constitution. Well, it was supposed to relinquish power 6 months after the fall of Mubarak, but they did not. It's been more than 10 months right now. And the assistant to the prime minister issued what is called supra-constitutional principles. Initiated by the Supreme Military Council, that gives the Military Council some kind of veto power over the new constitution and over the composition and the formation of the constituent assembly that would be chosen by the newly elected parliament to write the constitution. So in some sense, the Supreme Military Council is, after it took over the power of Mubarak back in February, it's trying to continue to control the country. But this is not really happening as part of kind of political regrouping in Egypt after the fall of Mubarak, and different groups have different interests now. Some have interest in a new election. Some don't have interest in a current election. They want the election to be held later because they think the Muslim Brotherhood are well-financed, well-organized, and they will take over the parliament. I'm talking about most of the activists on the ground, really, who did not have the chance to organize in political parties the way the Muslim Brotherhood are. But it's part of a really political regrouping in the whole region. There is an attempt by regional powers and by global powers to abort the outcomes of the Arab revolutions in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Yemen, in Syria, everywhere. And really, the heading for discussing this issue in the Middle East by most Arab commentators is counter-revolution, that the Supreme Military Council in Egypt is a tool of regional and global counter-revolution against that attempts to abort the Arab Spring or Arab revolts, mainly by Saudi Arabia that has been financing such counter-revolution. And Saudi Arabia is known to be one of the most oppressive regimes in the world, have no interest at all in any democratic transformation, not only inside Saudi Arabia, but any part in the region, because they think that will affect the conditions in Saudi Arabia. And of course, we know that other global powers like the U.S., who supported despotic regimes for a very long time, and European countries like France, who have some interest in the region, mainly oil, like the scenario of Libya testifies, don't have any interest, really, or any genuine interest in real democratic transformation in the region.
When hundreds of thousands of people across Egypt demonstrated to remove Hosni Mubarak from power, many people in those demonstrations viewed the army as a neutral arbiter and protector of the people of Egypt, helping to hasten the day that Hosni Mubarak left power. How has public opinion changed since the ouster of Mubarak?
Well, to begin with, there is a significant shift in the public opinion in Egypt regarding the Supreme Military Council. And they actually make a serious distinction, and that's really true, between the ordinary soldiers who are conscripts. They're the sons and daughters of the people of Egypt, and the Supreme Military Council, because it took over the office of the president. So they look at it as a committee with the power of president of the republic. Most of the people in Egypt, really, who participated, or the activists who participated in the revolution against Hosni Mubarak, are really intelligent, and they really understood from the very beginning that the Supreme Military Council was actually part of the Mubarak regime, and they still perceive it as such, and that explains much of its behavior, really. But obviously, the Military Council had no intention from the very beginning to surrender power, and that's what is bringing the current uprising against them.
That was Saif Dinah, Associate Professor of Sociology and International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside.
Hi, this is Dan Ellsberg. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice on Portsmouth Community Radio.
And here on Making Waves, we remind you on a few ways to participate in the future of our country. And one way to do that is to help support local community media, such as Making Waves and Portsmouth Community Radio. Give us a call at 603-430-9722 to become a member now.
And here comes another song for you. This one called Politic by Coldplay.
was fun to place. Give me time, give me space. Give me real, don't give me fake. Give me strength, reserve control. Give me heart and give me soul. Give me time, give us a kiss. Tell me your politics.
Give me heart and give me soul, wounds that heal and cracks that fix. Quite a turn of phrase from that song.
That was Politic by Coldplay. You're listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. I'm Amy Antonucci.
And I'm Steve Diamond.
We are co-producers of Making Waves and have been involved with Portsmouth Community Radio pretty much since it started 7 years ago. We're really proud of our part here at the station and hope that you too will join in supporting it.
Which you can do by calling 603-430-9722. Give us a call now.
Next on Making Waves, we're going to hear from Amy Goodman, a hero of ours in the media revolution and the producer of Democracy Now! She's speaking in this coming excerpt on November 3rd, 2011, in Syracuse, New York, about the power of people in movements.
We got this segment edited by New World Notes, which we then edited further down.
Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Amy Goodman is a journalist, executive producer of the news program Democracy Now!, and a leading advocate of independent news media. She spoke in Syracuse, New York on November 3rd. Political change is made not by great leaders, but by popular movements. It was the suffragist movement, not Susan B. Anthony, that extended the vote to women. Goodman tells the story of other movements, too. For instance, Rosa Parks was not a random lone individual when she broke the color line on the Montgomery Municipal Bus System in 1955. She was a well-trained, well-prepared member of an organized popular movement to integrate Montgomery City Services. Goodman also tells the story of the athletes at the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, who famously gave a Black Power salute on the winner's podium. And she tells of Occupy Wall Street and Tahrir Square. In solidarity, there is strength. And in popular movements, there is power. Not in charismatic leaders, but in thousands taking to the streets, if needed, to press their demands. That's what forces politicians to act. There's a summary of what Amy Goodman said. But let's hear the details from her.
You know, on Election Day 2008, I think the whole world heaved a sigh of relief when Barack Obama was elected president. Republican, Democrat, American, non-American, for so long people had hit their heads against a brick wall. They felt perhaps that wall had become a door, and the door had opened a crack, and the question was, would it be kicked open or slammed shut? And that's up to more than one person, because after all, the community organizer-in-chief became the commander-in-chief. What does it mean when he becomes commander-in-chief? People who did vote for him, the masses, the millions of young people who turned out, people, the people who were disenfranchised before, who never bothered to vote, who turned out. Suddenly they saw this right-wing backlash. They didn't want to contribute to it, but they also saw that the person who they had such high hopes in. I mean, I think the anti-war movement helped to elect Barack Obama. What was the only difference almost between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton? Barack Obama had been against the Iraq War, and Hillary Clinton had voted to authorize it as senator and hung on to her rationale until, well, almost the bitter end, when she realized she was losing on this point and finally said maybe it was a mistake. And yet the anti-war movement that helped to elect Barack Obama then went on to see that the war in Afghanistan, the longest war in U.S. history, had become Obama's war. That the person who one of the first acts in office had announced Guantanamo would be closed, within a year it hasn't been closed. That the man who talked about the importance of immigration reform, and now more immigrants have been deported under the Obama administration than under any president in history. Certainly well more than President Bush ever dared to have deported. When I say ever dared, because he knew the backlash that he would face from people who then went on to elect President Obama. And now what do they do when this president, who they elected, don't carry out their wishes? Well, there is a force more powerful than the most powerful person on earth. And that force is all of you, is people, is movements. It always has, it always will be. As Frederick Douglass said, power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. What determines movements is what you see the reality on the ground and what you want to do about it. And I think that's why we're seeing these Occupy encampments all over the country and all over the world. But these movements, how important they are what determine history. Rosa Parks, why it's relevant to talk about Rosa Parks today with the Occupy movement. You know how brave she was when she did what she did December 1st, 1955, right? Sat on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, refuses to get up for a white passenger, and she launches the modern-day civil rights movement. When the media covered Rosa Parks' death and her life, they got it wrong. Oh, they said she was a great civil rights leader, and that was true, but they said she was a tired seamstress when she sat down on the bus. They said she was no troublemaker. That's where they got it wrong. Rosa Parks was a first-class troublemaker. Rosa Parks knew exactly what she was doing when she sat down on the bus. She was the secretary of the local NAACP. She worked under E.D. Nixon, who came out of radical labor politics, who was the president of the NAACP. They've been challenging the racist laws of the South for years. Rosa trained at the Highlander Center, where Dr. King had been as well, black and white together, working to change the race laws in the South. But this was the magic moment. And you never know when that magic moment will come. I mean, think about the Occupy movement. But when you're involved in social change, you help to determine history. You lay the foundation. You do determine the future. And I think that is what we are seeing today. Do you remember John Carlos 1968, the Black Power Fist, the most famous, iconic sports moment in sports history, Mexico City, the Olympics? John Carlos got the bronze medal in the 200-meter dash. Tommy Smith got the gold. They actually were part of an Olympic Committee for Human Rights. They had been talking with Dr. Martin Luther King. This was 1968, about boycotting the Olympics. But then John Carlos knew when he flew into Mexico City, and Tommy Smith knew too, about what was happening in the United States and what was happening in Mexico. They decided they would run, but they would use their moment in the sun to change the world, and that's what they did. They walked out onto the medal stand after they won their race. With Peter Norman there, he took second. He was white. He was an Australian. John Carlos and Tommy Smith, when they put up their hands, each one with a black glove and a black power salute as the Star Spangled Banner played. In fact, Peter Norman, who was the white second place runner, he wanted to wear a glove too in support of them, but they didn't have a third one. And so he settled for the button, and he paid a price for this when he came home to Australia, as did John Carlos and Tommy Smith. They wanted to make this big monument for them at San Jose State. And he went there, and they showed him the model, and they were starting to carve the stone. And he said, no, I won't be any part of this. And the president of the university said, what are you talking about? We're moving forward on this. This is such a big deal. They commissioned a great artist. And he said, where's Peter Norman? And I said, no, this is you and Tommy. He said, no, only if all three of us are there, because Peter Norman was a critical part of what we did that day. And they said, he doesn't want to be a part of it. He said, I don't believe you. And he went into the president's office. They said, okay, call him. We got to build this monument. And he called him. He said, Peter, what's going on? Why aren't you on this medal stand that's being remembered for all time? He said, no, this is your moment. He said, but you can do something for me. And he said, what's that? He said, leave a space where I stood, and you could have a plaque right there if you want that says my name. But make sure you leave a space so that everyone who comes to see this monument can stand in my place and they can take pictures. And so that's what the monument is today. And it represents not only the three of them in that moment looking ahead, but everyone who comes to honor them. John Carlos was honoring the young people at Occupy Wall Street, saying, you are carrying on the torch. This past few weeks, the monument to Dr. King was dedicated in Washington, and President Obama dedicated that monument just down the road in front of the Supreme Court. Cornel West was getting arrested. And Cornel West said, as he was getting arrested with a number of other people protesting the level of corruption, that money, the level protesting what money has done to politics in this country, swamping politics, drowning democracy, said, if the monument to Dr. King is being dedicated today, I think there's no place that Dr. King would rather be than with me on the steps of the Supreme Court getting arrested. He said, someone has got to get arrested today. These movements and these moments, that's what Obama said to the person who asked about policy in the Middle East. He said, make me do it. That is the challenge today. That's how democracy operates. And first and foremost, we need a media that provides a forum to speak to, for people to speak to each other. That motto should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
Amy Goodman, speaking of movements earlier this month. Thanks for listening. Special thanks for Wilton Vaught, who recorded Goodman's talk on video and made it available to all on the internet. You'll find this and many other videos on Vaught's blog, essentialdescent.blogspot.com. You'll find our own website nearby at newworldnotes.blogspot.com.
Thanks to New World Notes for making that speech by Amy Goodman available to us. She spoke on November 3rd, 2011 in Syracuse, New York, about the power of people in movements. For more of Amy Goodman, you can listen here on WSCA Portsmouth Community Radio every weekday between 5 and 6 p.m. And if you like what you hear, we hope that you'll support it by becoming a member of Portsmouth Community Radio. Call us at 603-430-9722 or go online to portsmouthcommunityradio.org. Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our ending music is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show if you are not in range of the station by going to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org. Remember that WSCA is your community radio station and needs your support to remain on the air. Go to www.portsmouthcommunityradio.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday for our next Making Waves program.
And we leave you now with this quote from Amy Goodman. The media is absolutely essential to the functioning of a democracy. It's not our job to cozy up to power. We're supposed to be the check and balance on government, which is needed now more than ever.